The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'm going to be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and probably from the Harvard Health Letter as well. The first article is entitled The Essential Eight, Enhanced Advice for a Healthy Heart. And it comes from the Harvard Heart Letter of November 2022. The American Heart Association added healthy sleep patterns and made a few other key changes to its recommendations for lowering the risk of heart attack and stroke. An estimated 80% of all heart attacks and strokes are preventable. Are you doing everything you can to avoid these life-threatening events? An online tool from the American Heart Association, or AHA, called My Life Check, can help you find out. The new updated tool is based on Life's Essential Eight, the AHA's revamp of its Life's Simple Seven list of heart-healthy practices, which was created in 2010. The initial seven factors included maintaining a healthy weight, not smoking, being physically active, eating a healthy diet, and keeping blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol at acceptable levels. Life's Simple Seven was an important pivot for the AHA because it moved the organization's focus beyond the treatment of cardiovascular disease to include ways to prevent it in the first place, says cardiologist Dr. Elliot Antman, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and past president of the AHA. Now the association has added healthy sleep duration, 7 to 9 hours per night for adults, to the checklist, based on mounting evidence linking insufficient sleep to a range of cardiovascular-related risks. The domains of the Essential Eight are scored on a scale of 0 to 100, which are then used to generate a composite cardiovascular health score. To calculate your own score, go to My Life Check at the AHA website, which is www.mlc.heart.org. The 34-question survey takes just a few minutes to fill out, but you'll need to know your blood pressure, your blood sugar, and total and HDL cholesterol values. You have the option of entering either your fasting blood sugar value or your hemoglobin A1C. The latter, which doesn't require you to fast, is actually a better measure of blood sugar control because it reflects your average blood sugar over the past 3 months, Dr. Antman explains. But unless you have diabetes, some primary care physicians don't regularly order this test, so you may need to request it. Likewise, you may not need to fast before your cholesterol test. That's because the updated metric uses a non-HDL cholesterol measurement. Instead of simply asking if you smoke cigarettes, the new survey also asks about e-cigarettes or vaping devices and about exposure to secondhand smoke. Finally, the diet assessment was broadened. The questions help determine how close your diet comes to a healthy Mediterranean-style eating pattern, which emphasizes whole, plant-based foods and has been shown to prevent heart attacks and related problems. The details of Life's Essential Eight are described in an AHA presidential advisory published August 2nd of 2022 in the journal Circulation. The advisory also highlights the role of psychological health in cardiovascular disease. In line with this, the Life Check survey features a well-being assessment with questions about mental health, wellness, and social determinants of health. One question asks, how many days per month do you feel stressed or depressed? Another delves into potential contributing factors, asking whether you've experienced discrimination or bullying based on your race or ethnicity. Still others focus on social factors, whether you have access to high-quality medical care and live in a neighborhood with spaces to exercise safely and buy fresh produce. As the authors explain, these traits are multidimensional and challenging to measure, which is why they're not included as formal metric among the essential eight. Instead, we can think of these psychological factors as the foundation that underlies all the others, says Dr. Antman. As an individual person, you can use My Life Check to help identify and improve your own heart health score. But to make real progress population-wide, we need policy changes at local, state, and national levels, Dr. Antman says. Examples include things like increasing subsidies for healthier, less processed food and creating an accessible, safe place to exercise in parks and community centers. There's a short attached article that says, score more points for your heart. If you got a perfect score on My Life Check, which is 100 points, you're in a very exclusive club. Only 0.5% of people got scores that high in a study of 23,400 people published in September in Circulation. In fact, just 20% had scores of 80 or higher, putting them in the high cardiovascular health category. The data came from people who took part in the U.S. National Health and Nutrition Examination, which was a survey from 2013 to 2018. Their average score was just under 65, which suggests the heart health of the typical American is not great. If you need help nudging your score into the high category, the AHA provides fact sheets with targeted tips for addressing each of the eight metrics. And you can find those fact sheets at https://health.harvard.edu/LE8. Continuing with the Harvard Heart Letter of November 2022 is an article entitled, Put a Song in Your Heart. Music may help restore a healthy balance to the nervous system and orchestrate other changes that benefit the heart. Have you ever gotten goosebumps or chills while listening to music you really love? If so, you've experienced firsthand how this universal art form can evoke tangible, physical changes in your body. But the physical experience of listening to or creating music may go beyond a brief shiver of pleasure. It may even improve your heart health. There is growing evidence that music may benefit people with cardiovascular disease, says Dr. Peter Libby, a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. By and large, the effect appears to arise from music's ability to rebalance the two main branches of the body's autonomic nervous system, he says. This primitive part of your nervous system works on autopilot, regulating functions like your heart rate, your breathing, and blood pressure. One branch governs the stress, fight or flight response. The other controls the relaxation, rest and recovery response. Like practicing meditation or other calming rituals, listening to music or singing or playing an instrument helps nudge the nervous system to favor the relaxation response. The vagus nerve, which runs from the brain all the way down to the belly, mediates the relaxation response. Stimulating this nerve not only helps slow down your breathing, but also helps dampen inflammation, a key culprit in heart disease, says Dr. Libby. In 2021, the journal Trends in Cardiovascular Medicine published an article titled Effects of Music on the Cardiovascular System that reviewed the latest medical literature on the topic. The authors summarized results from 26 studies involving a total of 1,342 people. One consistent finding was a trend toward increased heart rate variability in people who listened to various types of music for anywhere from 7 to 70 minutes, either at one time or in multiple sessions. Heart rate variability, which measures the slight variation in time between each heartbeat, reflects the health of your autonomic nervous system. Higher heart rate variability values suggest the heart can quickly respond to rapid changes throughout the body, and this resilience is linked to better heart health. Only two studies looked specifically at the effects of singing, but they indicated that this practice also boosts heart rate variability. Here are some other findings from the review about music's potential benefit. Better exercise performance. Several studies suggest that music may improve a person's workouts, either by increasing endurance, distance, or duration, or by making exercise feel less effortful. In a study of people exercising as part of a cardiac rehab program, a technique that helps participants synchronize their pace with the chosen music, called rhythmic auditory stimulation, led them to exercise more. Two studies documented reductions in saliva levels of the stress hormone cortisol, including one in people undergoing dialysis, that hinted at improved cardiovascular survival rate among those with the biggest drops in cortisol levels. 30 young men with slightly elevated blood pressure followed the DASH diet, which is the dietary approach to stop hypertension, for a month. Those randomly assigned to listen to the best relaxing piano and flute music ever for 30 minutes, 5 days a week, during the month of dieting, had greater reduction in blood pressure and heart rate than those who did not listen to the music. Music's promising effects on health warrant further exploration, says Dr. Libby. Sound Health, a collaboration between the National Institutes of Health and the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, is doing just that, he adds. Meanwhile, listening to music is inexpensive, low risk, and easily accessible. There's no downside to using music to energize your workouts or to relax, so give it a try. They point out that, of course, you should keep the volume in a safe range. Now, the next article from the Harvard Heart Letter of November 2022 is entitled Ablation for Atrial Fibrillation. Why and when should you consider undergoing an ablation procedure, and how well does it work? If you have atrial fibrillation, a heart rhythm disorder marked by a rapid, irregular heart rate, you may have wondered about catheter ablation. For this therapy, a doctor guides a thin, flexible tube through a large vein up to your heart. A device at the tip of the catheter emits energy that destroys the tiny patches of heart tissue causing the heart's electrical misfires. Traditionally, ablation has been used as a second-line treatment for people with atrial fib who have debilitating symptoms and have had no success with medications. Evidence increasingly suggests, however, that undergoing ablation earlier in the course of the disease may be a good option, says Dr. Paul Zee, director of the Comprehensive Atrial Fibrillation Program at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. The chaotic heartbeat of atrial fibrillation often comes and goes, but it may eventually become chronic. While some people have no symptoms, most notice a fluttering or thumping sensation, and their heart rate may soar to 175 beats per minute, or even higher. Dizziness, fatigue, breathlessness, and other symptoms can occur, but the most serious consequence is an increased risk of stroke. There's a phrase cardiologists use, AFib begets AFib, which means the more frequent, longer bouts of AFib may trigger cellular changes that create other electrical instabilities inside the atrium, says Dr. Z. In some ways, he says, managing AFib is similar to fighting cancer. Early treatment with surgery and medication often controls the disease long term. But if you don't catch the problem until after it has spread, it's much harder to treat. In 2020, a large international study in the New England Journal of Medicine found that people recently diagnosed with AFib fared better when they were treated with rhythm control strategies, including certain medications or ablation, rather than standard first-line therapy, which usually involves drugs like beta blockers that slow down the heart. However, anti-arrhythmia drugs like dofetilide and flecainide, which have the brand names Tycosin and Tambacor, don't always work. They sometimes cause fatigue, sap energy, and can trigger a dangerous heart rhythm. Two subsequent smaller studies in the New England Journal of Medicine that compared ablation to antiarrhythmic drugs found lower rates of recurrent atrial fib and better quality of life among people treated with ablation compared to those treated with medication. Ablation success rates have improved dramatically in the two decades since the procedure was introduced. In addition, complication rates have dropped as doctors have gained experience doing the procedure. The overall success rate is about 75%. People sometimes undergo a second procedure if the first one isn't effective, and this boosts the success rate to 90%. However, many factors affect your outcome, including how long you've had atrial fib, your age, and any other heart problems or health problems that you may have. If you're considering ablation, ask about the success rate of your doctor's program and how they measure and track success, advised Dr. Z. Keep in mind that completely eliminating your atrial fib may not be possible, but occasional brief bouts of atrial fib during the years following an ablation rarely cause symptoms and are unlikely to affect heart function. Because atrial fib can promote clots and increase the risk of stroke, many people need to take anti-clotting drugs like Coumadin or Eliquis, which is also called apixaban, Pradaxa or dabigatran, and Xarelto or rivaroxaban. While some people may be able to stop taking these medications after an ablation, those at higher risk because of high blood pressure or diabetes usually should not. And there's a small attached article called Atrial Fib, How Long, How Often. Episodes of atrial fib are often unpredictable. Over time, atrial fib can become constant. Experts classify the disorder into four categories. The first category is paroxysmal. Here, episodes occur intermittently. They can be daily or just several times a year, but they resolve on their own with intervention within 7 days of starting. Then there's persistent atrial fib. An episode lasts for longer than 7 days. It doesn't resolve on its own and requires some type of treatment. Then there's long-standing persistent. Here the arrhythmia is continuous and has lasted longer than a year. And finally, there's permanent. The arrhythmia is continuous, it's lasted longer than a year, and it doesn't respond to treatment. Now, continuing in the Harvard Heart Letter of November 2022 is an article called Severe Neck Pain, a Sign of Something Serious? In rare cases, a torn neck artery can lead to a stroke. Learn about possible causes and symptoms. Last summer, news reports about a young woman who had a stroke after a visit to a chiropractor brought renewed attention to a rare but potentially devastating condition. Known as a cervical artery dissection, it's a tear in the lining of one of the main arteries that carry blood to the brain. The quick, jolting neck movements or adjustments done by some chiropractors and other care providers can trigger or exacerbate a tear. In my practice, I've taken care of a number of people who had a stroke on the chiropractor's table or soon after the visit, says Dr. Natalia Rost, a Harvard Medical School professor and chief of stroke services at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. However, a host of other activities and situations that cause sudden jerky neck movement can also cause tears in the delicate arteries in the front and back of the neck, she says. The activities she worries about the most are bungee jumping, riding a roller coaster, and whitewater rafting. Dissections have also been reported after strenuous weightlifting, high impact and high intensity workouts, and head flinging dance moves. Whiplash sustained in a car accident can cause a cervical artery dissection. There are two other documented triggers: hyperextending your neck while practicing yoga and tipping your head back to have your hair washed at a salon sink. The way to avoid this is to ask your hairdresser for a neck extension, a small cushion that props up your neck to prevent neck strain. Millions of people do these activities every day without experiencing any consequences. Cervical artery dissection is very rare, occurring only in about 3 in 100,000 people per year. In reality, these dissections may be more common than we realize. The good news is that, as with many other injuries, the body repairs and heals the damage naturally. Younger people are more likely to engage in activities that might precipitate a tear, which is the main reason cervical artery dissections are more common in this age group. They are one of the most common causes of stroke in people under age 50. As people age, other types of strokes, like those caused by brain arteries clogged with fatty plaque and blood clots that come from the heart, become more common. But dissection can strike older people as well. One study found that 1 in 14 people diagnosed with cervical artery dissection was 60 or older. Know the warning signs. A cervical artery dissection causes unusual, persistent, and severe pain in the neck and head that typically occurs either during or immediately after the activity that triggered the neck strain. With a carotid artery tear, The pain often spreads along the side of the neck, up to the forehead, eye, cheek, or teeth. A vertebral artery tear may cause a sharp pain at the base of the skull and the back of the head. If you experience a pain like that, especially if you also have stroke symptoms like dizziness, double vision, jerky eye movements, unsteadiness while walking or slurred speech, call 911 right away. Be aware that stroke symptoms can develop hours, days, or even a week after the dissection symptoms begin. Neck pain from a vertebral artery dissection may be one reason people seek care from a chiropractor. Chiropractors will correctly contend they didn't cause the dissection in the first place, but neck manipulation can make the situation worse by worsening the tear or dislodging a clot, which can precipitate a stroke. Says Dr. Rost, her advice, don't let anyone use any amount of force to push, press, or move your neck. And the article goes on to say, the two arteries that run up the front of the neck, the carotid arteries, and two others on the back of the neck, the vertebral arteries, are what is called the cervical arteries. A tear in the lining of one of these arteries, called a cervical artery dissection, causes blood to leak between the layers of the artery wall. The body's natural response to stop the bleeding by forming a clot may backfire, as a large clot may block blood flow through the artery or break off and lodge in a brain artery. Either scenario can cause a stroke. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.